afternoon, the Committee on Health and Human Services will be in order. We have several bills in front of us today, and we are going to start with Senator Hall's Senate File 381. And for the record, we do have a quorum. Senator Hall, you have the bill Hannah's Law.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. As I get started here on Senate File 381, I would like to offer the A1 amendment.
Senator Hall moves the A1 amendment. It's a delete everything, and that should be in your packets, members. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Amendment is adopted. Senator Hall, if you could explain.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Senate File 381, favorably named Hannah's Law, is in honor of a four-year-old little girl named Hannah Kazitsa, who tragically died last year after choking on a snack while at a child care center. We have a few testifiers here, and I'd like to introduce Vic Moore to start us out. And he is from the American Red Cross, or represents them.
Madam Chair, my name is
Mr. Moore.
My name is Vic Moore, and I represent the American Red Cross. And I'm sorry that you're stuck with me today. The experts at Red Cross have been deployed to Alabama to help with the harsh weather down there and the tornadoes. So I'll be very brief. I just wanted to state for the record that the National American Red Cross and the Minnesota chapters of the American Red Cross strongly support this legislation. And we've been involved in CPR training for a number of years. The training itself is fairly quick and efficient. It costs about $60. So we're very supportive of this and want to thank Senator Hall for carrying this bill, and particularly want to thank the Hannah family for bringing this forward, this very important legislation, and they deserve a lot of credit for this.
You're not so bad to get stuck with, Mr. Moore. That's fine. Thank you.
Madam Chair,
yes, Senator,
I'd like to beg to differ with that last statement.
There's a debate going on.
Ms. Chair, we also have, if I may proceed here, Ron Edlund, who is Hannah's father, that would like to share something.
Welcome, Mr. Edlund.
Hi. I'm Hannah's grandpa.
Grandpa, yes.
And sitting behind me is Jenny and Justin Kasitsa, Hannah's parents. And I'm only here just to tell you that the reason we did this or are doing this is because we had a little girl, Hannah, go to daycare one day and didn't come home. And as a result of that, I found out that only one person has to be licensed in a daycare. And we'll never know if it made a difference for Hannah. But I don't want another family going through this. So that's why we're here, and that's why we want your support.
Thank you, Mr. Edlund, and I'm very sorry about your loss, your family's
Thanks.
Loss.
So, Ms. Chair, the bill here would make it mandatory that teachers and teachers' assistants, all of them, would have to have CPR if they're in a daycare or a daycare provider, and we would stand for any questions.
And Senator Hall, can you just explain the difference between the A1 amendment and the original bill? Is there anything?
Yes. The the bill before you just mirrors the House bill, and there was a little tweaking that you can see as you read there. Yeah.
This part that was added.
Right. It starts on line 1.17. Deleting persons qualified to provide CPR training shall include individuals approved as a CPR instructor, and then putting in persons providing CPR training must use CPR training that has been approved. And then it goes on to say the American Heart Association, the American Red Cross, and incorporates psychomotor skills to support the instruction, or using nationally recognized evidence-based guidelines for CPR and incorporate psychomotor skills to support the instruction. Any questions?
Members, any questions for Senator Hall? Thank you. I know, Senator Hall, you've got some other people that would like to testify. Ms. Jenny Kerber. from the licensing division. That's what it says. I'm not sure. Sure. Oh.
No, I don't
think
so.
Jenny, sorry.
No.
We do have some technical help here if we need from Jerry, but only if necessary.
Only if necessary. I am so sorry.
That's
Mr.
Right.
Gerber. It says Jenny. And I did put my glasses on to make sure. And Mr. Moore, you were speaking for both of you and Ms. Cornish. Okay, that's great. Any other questions? Anything that you'd like to discuss, members, on this bill and this amendment? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, line 1.7 of your amendment talks about teachers and assistant teachers. Just having a little fun with her. are these high school or grade school licensed teachers in Minnesota that are coming out of the school system that go into a daycare center and provide some kind of programs or education?
Senator and Ms. Chair, I believe they're licensed daycare teachers.
Senator Newman.
Madam Chair, and not teachers coming out of the educational system,
that is
Department
correct.
Of Education.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Ms. Chair and Senator Newman. Unless they're also a licensed daycare teacher. So you're right. It does not refer to a teacher in the school system.
Senator Hall or Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we're not requiring additional training for CPR purposes for teachers involved in, the Department of Education.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Ms. Chair and Senator Newman. That is correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions? And Senator Hall, your wishes for this bill?
My wishes would be to move this to the floor consent calendar.
Senator Hall moves that Senate file 381 as amended be recommended, passed, and sent to the floor. Senator Fischbach.
Madam Chair, I think Senator Hall said the consent calendar, and I think that would.
Oh, consent calendar?
But I think that would be, I was just going to comment that I think that might be inappropriate.
Okay.
Probably belongs on general orders.
Belongs on general orders?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay.
So the motion would be to move it to the floor to general orders.
Oh, move to the floor to general orders. You want me to repeat that, members? Are you all right with that? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed nay. Motion prevails. Okay. Thank you,
Thank
Senator
you so
Hall.
Much, members.
Thank you very much. Mr. Edlin, Ms. Moore. We have Senate File 1173, Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, committee members, we are back with some good work having been done on Senate File 1173 when last we met. We asked the department and some stakeholder groups to meet and make some revisions. There have been revisions. The bill, as it stands before us, has an A1 amendment. There is an A4 amendment that we would like, as we lift this from the table, we'd like to look at the A4 amendment. And I'm
Senator going Benson, that's being passed out right now. So we have not adopted the A1. The A1 is what you're working on and the A4, is that correct?
The A1 amendment had been previously adopted. The A4 amendment amends the A1 amendment.
Senator Benson, can you move your microphone a little bit closer for both you and the testifier? Thank you. Okay, so the A4 is what needs to be adopted now. Can you just briefly explain the amendment, please?
Is this a working microphone here, too?
Yes.
Yes, the A4 amendment, which amends...
Matt, could you please announce your name for the...
I'm Christine Borsheim with the Minnesota Department of Human Services Child Safety Permanency Division.
Welcome, Ms. Borsheim.
Yes, thank you. The A4 amendment makes amendments to the A1 amendment primarily on the areas of definitions of parentage, and we can go into more detail in those on those areas when we walk through the entire bill. And there's also some changes to language. Excuse me, I'm looking right now. That has to do with relative search. And again, I'll walk through those in more detail when we get into the rest of the bill.
Okay. Ms. Borsheim, before we adopt, and Senator Benson, the A4 amendment, I know that Ms. White has an oral amendment that she'd like to discuss.
Madam Chair and members, there's one additional amendment that the Department of Human Services requested, and that's on the A4 amendment, page 1, delete line 2.
Delete line 2?
Yes.
Okay. And Ms. White, the 1173 as follows is deleted. No? The A4 amendment?
The A4 amendment amends the A1 amendment, and in that amendment, incorporate after line 1.2, page 1, delete line 2.
Okay. Any questions on that?
Madam Chair.
Senator Fischbach?
Madam Chair, maybe, and I think I missed something, because Senator Benson said that the A1 has been adopted, and now we're amending it. I guess I'm a little... Don't we usually, once it's been adopted, the engrossment or... Because did we do this in this committee? I guess... Okay. All right.
The A1 we did last week. The A4 we're doing right now with this oral amendment.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I was following because...
Well, I'm a little confused.
It's Monday. I'm a little slow, and I just wanted to make sure. So thank you.
Madam Chair, over here.
Senator Nino.
Thank you. I had a similar question. Maybe council can address this. And my question is, procedurally, can we adopt this language to adopt an amendment which has previously been amended, or procedurally, do we need to reconsider the A1 so it's before us again?
Madam Chair and Senator, we can adopt the A4 amendment to the A1 amendment.
Okay.
Somebody might have to help me with that language, but we'll get that done. Senator Benson, are you fine with that oral amendment to your amendment?
I accept the oral amendment as presented by Ms. White.
Okay. So we're ready to adopt the A4 amendment. Is that correct? Any questions on the A4 amendment? Senator Higgins, are you okay?
Getting caught up? I'm terrific, Madam Chair.
Okay. Super. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. A4 amendment is adopted. Senator Benson.
Madam Chair and committee members, I also have the A2 amendment, which amends Senate File 1173. And I'd like to ask Ms. Borsheim to give us the details of that amendment.
Senator Benson, let's just wait 1 second until that gets passed out.
Thanks.
That's not in your packets.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
We're back in this room where I can't hear again. So if everybody would just project, I'd have a chance to hear what anybody says. I'd sure appreciate it. What's nice being in those other rooms where you could hear.
It is a little tough. It is tough in here.
Unless the door was open, yeah.
Jenny?
Page 9, page 26.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Wow. Okay, Senator Benson, the A2 amendment. You could explain that, please.
Madam Chair, I'm going to defer to Ms. Borsheim from the department for explanation.
Okay. Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just in summary, again, I'll walk through these changes in more detail when we walk through the bill. We've been trying to kind of match up. But the A2 amendment includes an expanded definition of siblings for the purpose of placement decisions. It makes some additional amendments to relative search provisions. It amends provisions under the Multi-Ethnic Placement Act and Inter-Ethnic Placement Act, and it deletes all the provisions that were part of this bill that if you recall earlier, one of the kind of the scope of this was moving adoption proceedings from Chapter 259 into Chapter 260C. All sections and all provisions related to moving those adoptions proceedings have been deleted from this bill.
And Ms. Morsheim, is this the work from the discussion last week, or is this just from the interest groups that Senator Higgin was talking about? Can you explain the reason? This is quite expensive, actually.
Yes, it is. Madam Chair, yes, these changes were in response to the concerns raised last week by Senator Higgins and members of this committee on behalf of stakeholders. We convened a meeting the morning following our Wednesday evening hearing. We will probably intend to continue meeting on some of those provisions, but for today, what we're presenting is what we've all agreed to move forward at this time.
Senator Higgins, comments?
Thanks to the department and all the stakeholders who got together. I understand it was a very good meeting and that they're going to continue to do some work. And I appreciate the removal of the items that were still contentious after the meeting was done. And I think going forward, we've got a good bill now.
Thank you, Senator Higgins. Any other questions? Senator Nina.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at the amendment lines. Six and seven.
Senator Nino, I can't, you were mumbling.
Sorry. I'm looking at the amendment line six and seven. This has to do with the definition of sibling. It says, including siblings as defined by the child's tribal code or custom. And I don't know the exact context to this. Is this specific to those tribes with a physical presence in Minnesota? Is this any tribe of any sort? Is it specific to Native American tribes? What's the context of that?
Ms. Borsheim?
Madam Chair, Senator, you know, I don't think we'd be limiting that definition to Minnesota tribes. It's really about expanding the definition of siblings to allow us kind of the broadest possible application when we're making decisions around preferences for where children are placed, who they're placed with. So there wouldn't be a limit on just Minnesota tribes.
Is it specific to is tribe defined?
Ms. Borsheim?
Madam Chair, pardon me. I guess I didn't understand the question.
Is a tribal code or custom, is tribe defined anywhere?
Ms. Borsheim?
Madam Chair, Senator Nino, I am not sure if tribe is defined or not.
Welcome.
Madam Chairman, Senator, you know, yes.
Please state your name first.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. No
problem. Ann Alstrom. I am from the Children's Justice Initiative, which is a joint project between the Department of Human Services and the Minnesota Supreme Court, and I'm here on behalf of the Department of Human Services. And, yes, tribe is defined in federal law. There's a specific tribal listing and a process, and it's also defined in Minnesota law. This is in the context of Chapter 260C, which references the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act. All of that mirrors the same definition of tribe. So this is something that everybody knows what it means, if you will.
Thank you, Ms. Alstrom. Any further questions on the A2 amendment? Ms. White, did you have something? Senator Benson moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Amendment is adopted. Senator Benson?
Madam Chair, committee members, if you recall, we were materially through section or Article 1 of the bill and had started work on Article 2 when we ran into the stakeholder issue. And so I'm going to ask Ms. Bergstrom to summarize where we were and pick up where we left off in the necessity of timeliness here.
Okay.
Ms. Borsheim.
Yes, thank you very much. As Senator Benson just mentioned, we had, I believe, agreed to the provisions in Article 1. That was the provision that, or the section article that related to the administration of the Adoption Assistance Program. There that had been amended by the A1 amendment, which had been adopted, and there were no changes to Article 1 following our meeting on Thursday morning. So I think we're prepared to leave that where it was. The provisions in Article 2 are largely under the jurisdiction of Judiciary Committee because they're related to reform of the Juvenile Court Act in 260C for children alleged to be in need of protection of services, and covers the court procedures for achieving permanency. Many sections in Article 2 that look like new language are sections that have been reordered and renumbered to achieve a more logical and legally sequential order so that court proceedings are clearer. All sections, and those sections remain, all sections in Article 2 that were related to moving the adoption of children under state guardianship from 259 to 260C, as I mentioned earlier, have been deleted from the bill. There were many sections of Article 2 that contained provisions necessary for federal compliance, implementing fostering connections, and meeting Child Abuse Prevention and Treatment Act requirements. All provisions in Article 2 that were related to federal compliance remain as part of the bill. There were selected sections of Article 2, which I'll walk through in just a minute, that were sections 25 through 29 and sections 35. Those had been identified by Senate counsel as falling under the jurisdiction of this committee because they include requirements that pertain to duties of the Department of Human Services. Those sections covered relative search, administrative reviews of children in foster care, provisions for meeting Multi-Ethnic Placement Act and Inter-Ethnic Placement Act provisions, and other provisions that were necessary for meeting fostering connections. I said these sections remain in the bill. There were a few other sections as part of the bill that were also identified as being under the jurisdiction of this committee, sections 46, sections 50 to 53. They've all been deleted from Article 2 because they also pertained to the adoptions, which, like I said, have been removed in its entirety from the bill. So as we walk through this, I'll point out, like I said, there's been large sections now removed. Article 3, which we haven't had an opportunity to hear it yet, contains both technical and conforming language. Some of that's been deleted because it also applied to the adoptions sections. But there are other parts of Article 3 that were necessary for federal compliance, and there's some new provisions related to child safety that we'll be again kind of presenting in more detail when we walk through this. So if that's okay with you, it's my plan, I guess, to kind of focus on those sections of Article 2 that pertain to this committee and then the sections in Article 3.
Okay. So basically, Ms. Borsheim, would be sections 25 through 45.
Right, 25 through 29 and section 35.
Section 35, okay, super.
Okay, section 25 of the bill starts on page 44 at line 4415. Actually, we had, I think we were well into our discussion about the amendments to this part of the bill last Wednesday because there's been significant amendments to this section. Those amendments were part of the A1 amendment, and there's been one additional amendment to that as part of today's A4 amendment. So relative search, like I said, I think most of the amendments we had gone through at line 4421, there was an addition there from amendment, the A1 amendment, lines 5.4 through 5.10. And this has to do with the court having a findings of reasonable efforts. And as part of that finding, ordering that the agency would continue to involve relatives, continue consideration of relatives that are known to the agency at that time or might become known to the agency later on. At line 44.23, there was another amendment from the A1 amendment, lines 512 through 518. This included provisions for working with children in an age-appropriate manner to learn from them who their relatives or important persons are to them for the purposes of relative search. on line 44.32 of the bill. They're part of the A4 amendment from today, or the A2 amendment from today, does change the language. Previously, there was a strikeout for shall not and the addition of may. That has now been basically reinstated to its original state. And what it actually calls for is that a decision by a potential relative not to be identified as a permanent placement resource or planning for the child at the beginning of the case shall not affect whether the relative is considered for placement of the child with that relative later. We had proposed that it would be they may be considered, and at this point the amendment is that it would not be considered. There was also amendment at line 45.2. That's a part of the A1 amendment, lines 5.19 through 5.25. Basically, that defines what it means for a relative to participate in the case planning, in ongoing case planning for a child. And there was also an amendment at line 45.7 from the A1 amendment that covered relatives' rights to request notice. And that is on lines 5.29 through 5.33 of the A1 amendment. So most of the changes that we discussed Wednesday evening that we're amending this remain, with the exception of the one I just discussed. Excuse me here. Section 26, that was part of the A1 amendment as well. It was not part of the amendment. This is part of the bill that we didn't discuss last time. This actually covers those cases when a case is being heard every 6 months in a court proceeding. And there's also provisions for cases being reviewed every 6 months in an administrative review conducted by the agency. And what this provision really does is clarify that you don't need to be doing both. If the case is being heard, you do not also need to conduct an administrative review. So it eliminates some duplication of effort on the part of the agency and the courts. In sections 27 and 28, these are the sections that cover provisions of the Multi-Ethnic Placement Act and the Inter-Ethnic Placement Act. There were a number of amendments to this that were introduced just today. For the most part, what those amendments include is reinserting a language that we had proposed be changed. And so at page 50, on lines 50.1 and 50.2, that language is reinserted as part of the amendment we heard today. There is an insert at line 50.9, italic four, that training must also address issues related to cross-cultural placements. That's an addition. At lines 50.17 through 50.21, that language is also reinserted. On line 50.23, there is a change from the home study for purpose of adoption. Instead of must be completed by the licensing authority, we are changing that to may be completed. And at line 50.26, must in that line is also amended to read may. Other changes to section 28 are included on lines 51.5 through 51.7. And again, that reinserts language in that area that was previously deleted. Section 29 also was under the jurisdiction of this committee, and the provisions in this section relate to to those activities that we must do in terms of coming into compliance with fostering connections. Section 35 was the other section that we were going to talk about today, and that starts on page 56 of the bill, on line 56.16. And this actually has to do with foster care benefits past age 18. And again, this is a provision that ensures that we can implement fostering connections requirements. It does include or exclude eligibility for individuals past age 18 who have another source of support. Once they reach age 18, those provisions are included on lines 57.2 through 57.5. So that covers the Article 2 changes. Like I said, there's large sections of Article 2, as you'll note from the amendment, that have been deleted.
Ms. Borsheim, on that,
yes,
that you are taking out most of the language that deals with adoption proceedings, as you mentioned. What are your plans? Are you going to continue the discussion on those? Is that something the department's working on in the interim, or how?
Madam Chair. Yes, when we concluded our meeting on Thursday morning with stakeholders, I think there was agreement that much of the language around moving adoptions, I think there was just the concern was that we hadn't had adequate time to come to agreement on what that should be. And so we'll be convening throughout the summer months and hopefully coming to some agreement on what language we might bring forward in the next session.
And Ms. Borsheim, who will be at those meetings with stakeholders?
Well, Madam Chair, the people represented at our meeting on Thursday included legal aid representatives, representatives from the African American Disparities Committee, our Community Disparities Committee, county representatives, provider representatives, the Ombuds family, Ombuds office representatives were at that meeting. I think that covers, I think, most of it. We probably will be including additional adoption providers and hopefully some parent representation on that
CGI
committee.
CGI also.
CGI would also be, certainly.
Thank you.
Article 3 of the bill starts on page 85 at line 85.31. As I mentioned earlier, there is a number of sections here that are deleted because they applied also to the conforming to the adoption language. But there are remaining provisions here that we can talk about today. The first amendment is on... is part of the A1 amendment on page 7.5, or on page 7, line 7.5 to 7.27. And this amendment changes the definition of an Indian child. This is, again, for purposes of implementing fostering connections provisions. And that definition is now changed to mean a person under 21 years old instead of under 18 years old. All of sections 2 through 9 of Article 3 are deleted. Other changes in section 11... 12 and 13 actually are clarifying languages, language either for purposes of clarifying other changes to Article 2 or for fostering connections or CAPTA requirements. There is a new provision at Section 14 on page 93 at line 93.11. This provision is for disposition of a child when their parent is arrested for purposes or for reasons other than child endangerment. and it allows the peace officer who arrests the person to be directed by the parent who they would like to be the caregiver for that child. This essentially would eliminate the necessity for a child being placed in foster care if there wasn't a child endangerment reason. There's also a change related to Child Abuse Prevention Treatment Act requirements on page 96, on lines 96.2 through 96.4. And this provision, again, is necessary for CAPTA compliance, and it expands the definition of prenatal exposure to include the presence of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. This essentially does not change what's current in our Minnesota law, but according to CAPTA, it's necessary that this be explicit in our definition.
Senator Rosen.
Senator Sharon.
You may have addressed this, but I'm just reflecting back. I'm still behind where you're going. In Section 14, we're talking about the peace officer releasing a child to a designee of the arrested parent unless there's endangerment. And then it goes on to say the officer releasing the child has no civil or criminal liability. Is there language someplace else that, or procedure that that has an obligation of the officer to fully and thoroughly assess the proposed transfer a child to a person from the parent who is arrested so that the child is safe? You're relieving the person of liability here, but is there an obligation someplace else of a thorough assessment of the situation for the child?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Sharon. There's no other provisions in terms of the police officer providing any kind of an assessment of the situation. But if the arrest has to do with an issue that's not related to child endangerment, they would be making that decision at the time of arrest. Okay.
Ms. Ahlstrom.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, this provision, Ann Ahlstrom from Children's Justice Initiative on behalf of the Department of Human Services, this provision applies when parents are arrested, for instance, on traffic tickets or checks that have gone to warrant. So things that are not related to the care of their child, and this would allow the parent to say, my sister is perfectly fine, let her come get the children, or my next-door neighbor can come get the children. And then when the parent addresses the criminal issues frequently, very quickly, so within a day, the parent's out of jail and they can go retrieve their children, if you will. It prevents children from coming into the foster care system where that thorough assessment is done, and in Hennepin and Ramsey counties anyway, many of the children who come into foster care this route are released as soon as the parent is available to care for them, because there's nothing wrong with the parent's judgment about parenting. It's about other issues related to how they operate their lives. So there is no requirement for peace officers to assess the parent's judgment about who might be appropriate, because there's no question about their parenting ability as they come in contact with law enforcement.
Senator Sharon?
I don't know that, I'm just rapidly trying to read this. And on the earlier part of this paragraph, it refers to peace officer arrests a person in custody of a child may release a child to any person designated by the parent unless it is necessary to remove the child because the child is found in surroundings or conditions which endanger the child. So there is some reference to that situation, but then relieves the officer of liability. So I guess I'm unclear about the disconnect between those two things that you're describing.
Ms. Ahlstrom.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, The intent by the reference to Section 260C-175 is when the child's in danger, the child should be taken into custody. Law enforcement has that authority now. For instance, if a parent is arrested in a crack house, we would expect both the parent and the child to be taken into custody. It's when the when 175 does not come into play that the law enforcement officer has the authority to let the parent make the decision. Many law enforcement agencies do this now, but some do say we're worried about our liability, and so we don't feel we can do that. We want social services to do that assessment, which frankly costs the taxpayers a lot of money. And prevents children from getting as quickly as possible back to parents who are otherwise fine.
Senator Chair, fine? Okay, thank you. I remember the statute in the meth houses when we were working on child endangerment and really tightening up that, so it's a big deal. Ms. Borsheim?
Okay, Section 17 is the next change that I draw your attention to. That's, and the change is on page 105 at line 105.8. And the change here basically is that there would be no determination of maltreatment if the alleged perpetrator is a child under the age of 10. And what this really does is if there is a report of maltreatment and an investigation, that if the child's under age 10, the focus would be more on getting children the services they need versus labeling as a perpetrator. There have been instances where a child might be subject to this, and then at the age of 17 or 18, once they're applying for a job and a background check is done, they have a child maltreatment finding in their background, which would prevent that. So this would solve that issue. Okay. The last change that I bring to your attention is starts on page 108. The section is Section 19, Administrative Reconsideration and Review Panel. The changes are on lines 108.36 through 109.11. And what this change essentially does is remove the requirement that the commissioner convene a panel to review findings from maltreatment investigations held in facilities. Currently, if there is a facility investigation and a no maltreatment finding is a conclusion, persons can ask for that finding to be reconsidered. Since the establishment of this panel, we've probably reviewed and had that request reviewed about 2 cases per year. The panel has no authority whatsoever to overturn the finding, only to review if the process and procedure were followed. Our concern is that it sometimes kind of holds out in kind of in a disingenuous way that there's some way to have that finding overturned, and there's not. And we also then provide actually a report to the legislature each year what the activity of this panel has been and what the findings have been, because it's really, like I said, it's really not utilized. We're asking for us to eliminate this requirement.
Ms. Borsheim, are you eliminating the panel or just the requirement?
Madam Chair, we would be eliminating the requirement to have the panel.
I see. Questions? Ms. Borsheim? Senator Sharon.
Yeah, I'd like to just, so am I correct in understanding then, if a decision is made, there is a desire to have a review, an appeal of that decision. With this, there is no appeal process in place?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, this panel is not the same as an appeal. It basically, like I said, it reviews the process that was and procedure that was taken in terms of the investigation. It can make a recommendation back to the investigating authority that they might want to run a reconsider something, but it's not the same as an appeal process.
Just to follow up, Senator Rosen. With or without this, is there an appeal process of a decision that's been made? in law?
Ms. Borsche.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I'm going to check. I need to check with someone on this quickly. I believe that there is an appeal process that exists. Let me check that out.
Ms. Ahlstrom.
Madam Chairman, Senator Sharon, if you look at the lines that are added in at line 9 and 10 and 11 on page 109, the hearings specified under this section are the only administrative appeal of a decision issued under paragraph A. That refers to the appeal process. So there is an appeal process. It is for positive determinations, if you will. In other words, a determination that there was child maltreatment. What's being eliminated is a panel that looked at somebody who requested when there was no finding of child maltreatment. So it was a negative review, if you will. So there is an appeal of a positive determination.
Senator Sharon?
I think we can get more complicated. Maybe I need to study this further. I'm curious to know that if there is, what you're saying is that if somebody really believes there should have been a positive finding, that they ought to have a second look, that there's not a process for that.
Ms. Ahlstrom?
It's only if you find a positive finding, so they can appeal the positive finding and hopefully negate that. But the reverse is not true. If there has been no finding, and somebody really says, hey, you better have another look at this, there's no process for that. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, that is correct. This is in the context of a daycare or a licensed child care facility, so it's not something that happens with parents. There is that process with parents. So only if there's a positive finding is there an appeal process. There isn't the reconsideration process that we have for something that happens in the home. So this was the process, but again, it's toothless. Ms. Sullivan Sutton is pointing out that there are also review procedures for children who are determined maltreated or not in schools.
Senator Sharon? Thank you. Ms. Borsche.
The rest of the sections, like I said, there was no change from our meeting on Thursday, including revisers, instructions, and repealers. I think that kind of concludes what I was going to present.
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair and committee members, if there are no further questions, I would move.
Well, Senator Benson, I should ask if there are some questions. I just thought maybe you had some comments. But you've done a lot of work on this and appreciate you taking it back and making sure that everybody's issues were taken care of on this. Any questions from the committee? White.
Madam Chair and members, just one more technical correction. I'm noticing that there's some places where the term percentage is used instead of parentage, and if staff could just have the authority to correct that. It should reference the Minnesota Parentage Act. Instead, it says the Minnesota Percentage Act. So I'll look through the entire stack of documents and make sure that term is correct.
Okay, thank you, Ms. White. Senator Benson, you're fine with that?
Yes, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. White. I just noticed that on the A4 amendment. I appreciate the work of counsel and the advice of Senator Higgins and the work of the department on getting this into its final form. And with that, Madam Chair, I would move Senate files 1173 to the floor.
I would recommend as 1173 as amended be recommended
judiciary.
To move to judiciary.
Judiciary.
I
apologize.
Madam Chair.
I had no excuse today.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, would you indulge me and let me fix up some punctuation?
Absolutely, Senator Higgins. Make it a good day.
Page 105, line 7. The phrase is, after conducting an investigation, the local welfare agency shall make two determinations, colon, first, blah, 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 and second, blah, blah, blah. Okay. So delete the semicolon on line 105.7 and insert after the and, right after the semicolon, a comma after and. So first, whether maltreatment has occurred, and second, whether child protective services are needed.
Senator Higgins, does that comma after second have to be taken out?
Yes. No, it stays in. So there's a comma on both sides of the word second, both before and after.
Senator Benson?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, I will accept the oral amendment as presented. Thank you.
I didn't hear what she said, but she smiled. So,
sorry. I apologize, Senator Higgins. I will use my outside voice when I'm in this room.
Thank you.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does this bill not go to
judiciary?
Not to the floor.
It's going straight to judiciary.
And yes. Madam Chair, Senator Newman, I apologize. I misspoke. It should go to judiciary.
Thank you.
So Senator Benson renews her amendment at that Senate File 1173 as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to judiciary. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Benson, Ms. Borsheim, Ms. Ahlstrom.
Thank you.
Good work there.
Good evening. We get to work on
that. Senator Newman, Senate File 1305.
It's always tough when you have a bill that starts with data practice.
Oh, yeah. Shoot me now.
Glad to see you.
Special family daycare homes licensure classification expansion.
Just jump. Senator Newman, when you are ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just going to make a couple of opening remarks, and then we do have an amendment that I would like to address. Senate File 1305, Madam Chair and members, is a is an agency bill involving licensing and pertains to background studies, licensing, and so forth through the Department of Human Services. The bulk of the bill involves clarifying definitions, and is being proposed by the agency to enhance efficiencies in Minnesota statutes that will effectively help the department licensing activities.
Senator Newman, I could see Senator Higgins shaking her head. You need to pull that closer. Thank you.
He's going to go buy me some.
I am going to blow her out of here.
Yes.
Madam Chair, for the first time this session, she has actually heard something. My apologies, Senator Higgins. What I was indicating, Senator Higgins and members, is that this is a licensing bill, clarifying in nature, and is designed to help in terms of the efficiencies in carrying out their duties in both background checks and in licensing. I do want to point out that licensing can be thought of as frankly, kind of a dry topic. But I would like the members to take in or keep in consideration that, number one, the purpose of it is essentially to protect our children when they are in daycare facilities. But the other side of the coin, the other thing I would like you to keep in mind, is that every one of us has constituents in our districts who have daycare facilities. And by the very nature of this licensing bill, we are affecting their ability to earn a living. It's their occupation. So in that respect, it is both important to protect the children and to help our constituents insofar as their employment is concerned. With that, at this point, Madam Chair, I would like to offer the A1 amendment, which will put the bill in the nature or in the form so that we can proceed.
We lost the Madam Chair. Sorry, Ms. Senator Newman.
That's fine, Mr. Chair. When I looked up, you had changed genders. I am at this time, I am offering the A1 amendment, Mr. Chairman, in order to put the bill in the appropriate form.
Yes, I'm sorry. Members, just a little switch over here. But Senator Newman moves as author's amendment, the A1 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries, and you have the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At this point, I would ask that the department, I have Mr. Kerber, and I have another member here that will, in effect, present the bill. As we go through it, I may have some questions, and I'll want to interject. But at this point, we'll allow the department to proceed with presenting their bill. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
You. Mr. Kerber, or please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Laura Plummers-DeRust with the Department of Human Services Licensing Division.
And before, could you, I don't know if we have your name spelled on the, looking here very quickly. Could you spell your last name?
Yes, Z-R-U-S-T. Z as in zebra, R-U-S-T.
Z-R-U-S-T.
Correct.
Pronounced again?
Zrust.
Zrust. Thank you, Ms. Rust.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just giving some clarification there. I will mention the amendments then in the context of the entire bill as we go through. As Senator Newman mentioned, this bill does amend a number of licensing statutes that he mentioned pertaining to licensing of human services overall. They are primarily clarification. This bill does not impose any additional costs on state budget. Article 1 is regarding data practices amendments. There's just Section 1 here. And firstly, what it does is reformats the licensing data provisions under Paragraph B just to make those easier to read in terms of adding items because of its length. This restates the current law regarding when determinations of maltreatment and disqualifications are public data on a license holder or applicant. It does add to this section that the reason for the disqualification and the reasons for the disqualification not being set aside will now also become a public data when the sanction or denial is based on the license holder's disqualification. And then there's an amendment to paragraph I that clarifies that licensing data collected pursuant to multiple licensing investigations under all of the laws that's been mentioned here by Senator Newman, that may be shared with regulatory boards when necessary under their jurisdiction. Article 2 then includes Human Services Licensing Act amendments, and those are found in Sections 1 through 13 of this bill. Sections 1 through 3 add three definitions, conservator, guardian, and primary residence, as those terms are used in statute and rule. Section 4 amends the license application requirements. First, it provides that when an application is incomplete or deficient, the applicant is given the opportunity to submit a second application. It was amended in the A1 from 45 to 90 days to allow that to occur. The amendment also deletes the second piece of this Section 4 that provided for a competent knowledge of the licensing applications, written examination. There were some concerns expressed about that, and we're going to consider those further over the interim. Thirdly, this provision requires the individual applicant as well as non-individual applicants to provide identification, including for the individual, such as their Social Security number, their driver's license, et cetera, and then for the non-individual, their tax ID information, et cetera. It also provides identification required when you have agents accepting service on behalf of the controlling individuals, whether they reside in or outside of the state, what identifications or requirements there are in those settings. And Sections 6, 8, and 9, I'll just mention now, contain conforming amendments.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
If we could go back, Mr. Chairman, to I think it's Section 4, beginning at paragraph, which is now F, with the amendment being adopted, line 8.6. There's a requirement in the bill which will require a non-individual, i.e. a corporate entity, to provide the Social Security number of the individuals who are the controlling members of the corporation. And I will tell you, members, that I have had a couple of constituents who have been concerned about the fact that they are required to provide their personal Social Security number when, in fact, they are operating in the context as a corporation or a legal entity. And I guess I would ask members to question the requirement of the need to provide a personal Social Security number when a federal tax ID number is required to be made available. And I would request the department to, if you would, please explain the need for the Social Security number when we are, in fact, dealing with a corporation.
Mr. Kerber?
Mr. Chair, members, and Senator Newman, what we're trying to do with this provision is two things. One is we're trying to comply with a parallel requirement that the Department of Revenue has regarding they ask us on a regular basis to turn over information that we have about who are the license holders out there and what is the license number that they're associated for tax purposes. Part of this is to comply with that, and that's why we're seeking the Social Security number of individuals who become license holders, and then also the tax ID number for non-individuals. What we were pursuing here a little bit further, we on a regular basis we struggle with trying to figure out who is really operating the business that we are licensing, and on a regular basis we struggle with trying to make sure we have the right people identified. There are other provisions in the law that the legislature has passed that say that we have to do background studies on those individuals, and if those individuals have certain characteristics, then they are not eligible to be controlling individuals for a DHS license program. And so what we're just trying to figure out to make sure that we've got the right people involved here. And you know, for better or worse, one of the better ways to do it is to identify Social Security number of the individual.
Mr. Kerber, and I think that was a signal to bring the microphone up close to you as you testify. But so I'm clear on this, the Social Security number then is used by the department to identify people for purposes of background checks. Is that correct? Is that required under this provision that the non-individuals, as Senator Newman has mentioned, corporate entities, the people on the boards, are their background is screened as a result of this?
Mr. Chair, this provision is not requiring a Social Security number for the purposes of background studies. Background studies are required under a different section of the law, and we'll get into some other sections. And we don't have currently the authorization to request Social Security number for that purpose. Although it's increasingly required to check it against federal exclusion lists, like the Office of Inspector General maintains a list of individuals whom the state needs to be preventing from being enrolled in one of the public programs, receiving public funding. But we currently don't have the authority to request the Social Security number for that purpose, and we're not doing it here. What we're doing here is really primarily to satisfy the Department of Revenue requirement that we identify for them on an annual basis the Social Security number of the people that we license. And I'm assuming that the Department of Revenue does some other checking with that information against taxes.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, yes, Senator Newman, I'm not sure if I think the concern about Social Security number is appropriate, and I think Mr. Kerber, I mean, the need for it for Department of Revenue, whether that's right or not. The difficulty with these things is there's so many things we never think of and how they fit through. I think part of the provision, some of these provisions in here in that section came because last year there was some woman who was opening a daycare center, and in order to and she had a criminal record, so she couldn't open a daycare center. So she gave him a different name, and they did a background check on the wrong person. In other words, because there was no ID, no way of knowing. In other words, if I've got a criminal record, I'd go in and apply for a license under Senator Hall's name, and they do a background check on him. And it was one of those weird things where nobody did, which is, I think, why they're trying to get some of this. I think the Social Security number is probably more Department of Revenue, but who thinks of those? I mean, it's a pretty weird loophole, but we do all this background check, and then somebody turns in their name to get a license under somebody else's name.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
I think we're having a little, at least I am, having a little confusion between what Senator Marty just said and what Mr. Kerber said. And it seems to me that if the Social Security number is needed for the purposes of doing a background check, i.e. the protection of children, then I can understand it. If, however, as Mr. Kerber indicated, that the purpose of the Social Security number is to assist the Department of Revenue, then I disagree, because it is a corporation that the Department of Revenue is dealing with. And if I understood Mr. Kerber correct, the background study involving the individuals who are in direct contact with the children is done under a different statute. And if I am correct in my analysis, then I think it's inappropriate to allow the Department of Human Services to have the Social Security number of individuals, because, you know, we're dealing with owners, officers, and managerial officials of that corporation, and I just think it's going a bit far in order to require that Social Security number for that purpose.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Kerber, I didn't believe that all daycares were registered as corporations. I thought there were daycares that were operated as family businesses and were operated as an individual. And so I think this would cover those situations also, and in that case would be appropriate.
And, Senator Berglund, I'm just wondering, and perhaps Mr. Kerber can provide some clarification, that section above, Section F, has that been deleted, though, by the amendment where it talks about when an applicant is an individual, the individual must provide the Social Security number? Did
no,
you say that
was Mr. Chairman, the paragraph you're looking at is, I believe, 8.3 under the amendment. That is now paragraph E. In your bill, it's paragraph F, and involves applicants that are individuals.
And so in the case where a daycare center was operated by an individual, would that cover the circumstance that Senator Berglund was raising? Or,
yeah.
And I guess I'm trying to understand, if that's the case, then the part that's in the next paragraph dealing with the non-individuals, I think it's a good point. If this is something that the Department of Revenue is using for its purposes, then you got to kind of wonder what they're doing. I'm not sure that it's appropriate to your point, Senator Newman. I'm willing to hear the argument, but I'm not sure if I'm hearing it.
Mr. Chair, and to Senator Berglund's question, yes, paragraph the new paragraph E is intended to deal with individuals who seek a license, and new paragraph F, formerly G, is dealing with non-individuals or organizations that are made up of individuals. And there are about 24,000 licenses that come under this licensing act. It's more than child care. It's any services for people with developmental disabilities, chemical dependency treatment, mental health treatment programs, adult daycare centers, and it's a whole host of programs. licensed by Human Services, and including foster care. And some of those licenses are issued to individuals, and some, even in the foster care world, are considered to be corporate foster care, and some are more family foster care. And so that's what paragraph E is intended to deal with. And paragraph F, as Senator Newman is pointing out, we are asking for the corporate ID there, but we are admittedly going a little further and trying to figure out who are the individuals behind that corporate ID number, and seeking to identify them by Social Security number for corroboration with the Department of Revenue where possible. We have a lot of people in Minnesota who have very similar names, and some have more troubling background than others. And so we're challenged on a daily basis with those identity issues, and this is merely seeking to give us a little bit more, a little stronger tool to identify that, but if it's going too far for comfort, we understand that as well.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
I'm going to make an oral amendment at this point. Mr. Chairman, line 8.7, strike Social Security number. And then maybe council can help me make sure I'm not goofing anything else up. But I would move that for purposes of non-individual applicants, we strike the requirement to provide Social Security numbers of the individuals that are involved with the corporation. And I've already indicated my reasons why. I just don't believe that we are addressing an issue concerning the safety of children. I think we are addressing an issue involving the Department of Revenue, and the Department of Revenue has their tax ID number. So,
and Senator Newman, I think technically you'd have to strike comma and Social Security number, and then insert an and after the comma after name. And
I would incorporate that in my amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members, and I think we need one more and. So the sentence would actually read, when an applicant is a non-individual, the applicant must provide the applicant's Minnesota tax ID number and the name and address of all individuals who will be controlling individuals.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Can somebody tell me why they want to protect the people behind these corporations?
And I'll let perhaps Senator Newman, but as I understand it, what the department is saying is the Social Security number is there primarily to serve the purposes of the Department of Revenue.
Yeah.
And
so?
We're not sure, I'm not sure what that function would be. I think that a corporate entity does have a tax identification number that I would argue would be sufficient for that purpose, but I think that's the argument, is it's not necessary. And Senator Newman, you can certainly.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins. The way the bill is worded, the Social Security number of people who work for the corporation is being required when, in point of fact, those individuals very well may have no contact whatsoever with children. They may be back at the corporate office working and have no contact. This Social Security number that is being requested is not being requested for the purposes of background check or the safety of children or anybody that's dealing with the children. And corporations do have a legitimate purpose in our business world. And so given the fact that a Social Security number is being requested of, for instance, a managerial official of the corporation who very well might not have any contact whatsoever with children, I think it's overreaching and I think it's unnecessary, because the Department of Revenue has the Minnesota tax ID number, and they will have the tax returns being filed by the people who work for that company. So long as we aren't in the area of requiring this Social Security number for the purposes of a background check to protect the children who are coming in direct contact with that individual, I think it's inappropriate.
I have
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, if you were somebody who had gotten in trouble previously for one thing or another and in this type of business using your own name, it would be so easy for you to go set up a corporation, get a different tax ID number, and then hide behind that and go, you know, and go do the same thing that you got in trouble with before. And I think with your amendment, you're tying the hands of the department by not being able to see who's behind some corporate name and some tax ID number. You know, we're the land of, you know, Dave Olson and Mark Anderson and Bob Johnson and, you know, I always said if you wanted to hide out for the law, you know, move to Minnesota, change your name to Dave Anderson, you know. There are hundreds of them in this state. But if you can get in trouble and then just go skirt around, you know, the licensing agent by getting a corporate name and a corporate tax ID and go back and do the same thing that got you in trouble the first time, there's something wrong with that. And this would be the way that we could get around that. So I think that you're well-meaning in your amendment, but I think it isn't appropriate to make that change.
Thank you, Senator Higgins. I have questions from Senator Lurie, Senator Berglund, Senator Higgins, and Senator Marty. So we'll go. And I'm sorry, Senator Hoffman. Did I mention that? Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Newman, I think one of the reasons we're struggling with this a lot is that we're the Health and Human Services Committee. I think the next stop is going to be Judiciary, where their primary focus is data practices. I mean, maybe they would be better equipped to have a better discussion and dialogue about the appropriateness of the Social Security number in this context. They deal with this day in and day out, and thank goodness I don't serve on that committee. I know Senator Marty does and can bring some of the thoughts that, and it is appropriate for us to discuss it here. I'm not suggesting that, and we can certainly adopt this amendment, but I think that sending it over to Judiciary with this language in and an express intent to have a further conversation regarding a piece in this bill that is really a data practices issue with regards to how we use tax ID numbers and Social Security numbers, both for the safety of children or people receiving services, but also for tax compliance issues. These are very prickly issues, and we could sit and struggle with this for a very long time in health and human service contexts and run the risk of not getting the proper balance. I would maybe suggest you know, sending this along with this provision still in it and having the further discussion over in Judiciary, just as a suggestion for your consideration, Senator Newman.
Senator Newman.
Well, I guess, you know, I thank you, Senator Lurie, and the very reason why I brought it up at this time in this committee is because this is the committee that deals with the protection of the children. And it's my contention that the requirement of the Social Security number in this context doesn't have anything to do with the protection of the children, and that's why I'm asking this committee to take that issue up.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, on that point, if I could just follow up.
We'll let Senator Lurie follow up.
No, that's fine.
Senator Lurie.
Thank you. But just because it doesn't deal with the safety of children doesn't mean that it's wrong. And so, you know, I mean, sending it over to the data practices folks for a determination of whether it is an appropriate use of Social Security numbers outside of, and I'm not going to take issue with you about it not being for the security of children, but, you know, I mean, that's why I think it's kind of outside of the jurisdiction of this committee. Were it regarding the safety of children, it would be for us to ferret out and within this jurisdiction. And again, I mean, it's perfectly fine for us to adopt this amendment if you pursue it, but it is outside of our expertise, if you will, that we carefully craft, in that it's admittedly not about the protection of children. It's about revenue aspects, but it is still under the licensing law at the Department of Human Services, which was the point of my comment. So take it or not, it's fine.
Senator Berglund and then Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Kerber, This information that you receive at the time you issue licenses, is it ever used to help detect fraud and Medicaid abuse?
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, that would be our one of our primary intents here is to make sure that we're not issuing a license to somebody who has that history. Make sure that we have the people we're dealing with, and it's not part of the background study, so I don't want to sound inconsistent on that. But there are other requirements in place for checking against the Federal Office of Inspector General list to see if people are disqualified from being an owner or managerial official of an agency because of past events that have gotten them on that list, including defaulting on loans and things of that nature. But there is a federal prohibition for some people to be working in a setting that receives federal funding. And so this would be helpful for that, but I don't want to overcharacterize it as being part of our background study system. It's really so that we can have a better understanding of the identity of the people that we are issuing the license to for all purposes. Separate from this, and if this amendment goes through, I think what we'll do is we'll go back and look at this more, maybe come back next year with a more developed approach to how we want to include Social Security number perhaps in some background study language. There's more and more interest in that kind of thing anyway from the federal government. So,
well, Mr. Chairman, I just like to say that I think if this licensing information is sometimes used to detect instances where fraud and abuse might be occurring in our Medicaid program, then I think we should leave the Social Security language in the bill, and I would ask you to consider that as well. Senator Newman, and I mean, I think when fraud and abuse is taking place, you really do need to know which person it is that you're talking about, and I'm not sure the rest of this information is going to give you a clear enough indication of who the person is to be able to focus the investigatory efforts properly.
Mr. Kerber, has it been the experience of the department that they wish they've had this information in the past that they regret not having? That, I mean, has there been a number of instances of fraud and abuse that they said, well, gee, if we would have had that, it would have, I mean, has that been the experience of the department?
Mr. Chair, yes, I think there have been a number of cases where we've been really struggling with trying to figure out who it is that we have issued the license to. In some cases, we're dealing with applications that come in, and the names are similar names to the people who we've had previous licensing issues with, and we're struggling to figure out, is this the same person or not? And sometimes when we confront the applicant, we say, well, you know, we've got a history with this person, and that person then, so then we get documentation saying, okay, well, that person's no longer affiliated with the application any longer, then take them off. And so it's our interest. Just this morning we've had conversations with the Department of Revenue trying to figure out, well, who are the individuals behind this corporation? And we're doing that, I'll just say, because we take the responsibilities in the licensing statute quite seriously, where there are certain people who we are not supposed to be issuing a license to, and people who have engaged in different fraudulent behavior or have other criminal history in their past. And so, you know, we really struggle with that. And so this was an attempt to get one more tool here by being able to query their Social Security number and ask the Department of Revenue, is this person affiliated with this corporate tax ID, to the extent you can tell us?
Senator Hoffman and then Senator Marty.
I'm going to pass. Most of my questions were answered.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I think Senator Lori is right. We should probably bring it to Judiciary, where Senator Newman and I both sit, and I think several others here too. I'm inclined to support taking it out because I know Social Security numbers are supposed to be used for tax and Social Security purposes and nothing else, not licensure. I think if you hold it off till that point, then the department, I think, can take another look at it to see if this will help the fraud stuff and so on or not. And I think if they have a couple of days before then, it might be helpful if there is, because I'm inclined to think, yeah, when we want to, well, let's get this information and so on, and some of which doesn't really apply to it. And I think Senator Newman's point may well be right, but maybe we just wait a couple of days for the amendment when it gets to the other committee, and then the department can figure out, is this going to be useful, and if so, how? Because in general, when we're trying to get some information, we'll, let's ask for this and this and this, they'll all be helpful, and but are they necessary, I guess is the question.
Senator Newman has an amendment before the committee. Any other discussion? No discussion. Our members clear on the amendment. It's essentially removing the requirement of Social Security from paragraph, new paragraph F. Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No. No.
Motion carries. Senator Newman.
I'll continue on.
Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Section 5 was deleted by the A1 amendment. Section 6, I've addressed already, is a conforming amendment to Section 4. Section 7 is also modified by the A1 amendment. This section revises the children's residential facilities provision to better match a federal funding now available to these providers. And basically what it does is it allows these residential programs to serve persons through the age of 20 if they meet the additional specified requirements. Sections 8 and 9 are also conforming amendments to Section 4, which I've discussed already today. Section 10 amends the scope of the contested case hearing provision to specify, first of all, that the scope of the contested case hearing relating to a disqualification does not include the issue of whether the commissioner was required to seal agency records according to the district court order or other applicable law. And there are a number of other provisions that I'll mention later that have conforming amendments to this. And then secondly, it provides that if a license holder is already under a sanction and they've appealed that and they have subsequent violations, those violations will automatically be included in the scope of the hearing. Section 12 is deleted in the, or excuse me, Section 11. Sorry, I got off the track here. Section 11 amends a license fee provision to adjust the invoicing time for agency efficiency purposes. Section 12 is the section that was deleted by the A1. And Section 13 adds variance authority so that programs that provide independent living services for youth may at times with adequate attention serve clients with chemical use problems as well. Sections 14 through 29 now amend the Human Services Background Studies Law, which is Chapter 245C. Section 14 clarifies that studies are not required on foster care recipients. Section 15, which is also an A1 amendment, this, first of all, specifies that a license holder that must initiate a background study when an individual returns to a position. That's currently in the law. And right now it's a 45-day absence. We're extending that to a 90-day absence. So if they're absent, an individual's absent 90 or more consecutive days. And then it also provides that if an individual's disqualification was previously set aside and a new study is done, if there's no new information that indicates the risk of harm, the previous set aside is going to remain in effect for that. And then the A1 amendment added paragraph K to this section. And what that does is basically clarifies the law and provides for, in family child care settings, they use substitutes. And even extending this to a 90-day time period really still doesn't work for those settings. So the family child care provider suggested that it would be more workable to have those studies done with relicensure. So that's what paragraph K does. Section 16 amends our electronic transmission process for background studies, what we call Net Study, that applicants have to use this electronic transmission system unless they receive a hardship variance from us, and the basis for that hardship variance would be if high-speed internet is not available in their area. Section 17 makes consistent with requirements of current law, also stated under Section 22, so it's consistent with Section 22, clarifies that law enforcement agencies are required to provide arrest and investigative data to us for purposes of our background study. Section 18 clarifies that probation officers and correction agents must notify the commissioner of an individual's conviction when the individual has been affiliated with one of our licensed programs for the preceding year and they're convicted of a disqualifying crime. Section 19 provides for individuals that are affiliated with a license holder that has multiple programs that we license. If we're conducting a background study relating to child foster care, then that study can transfer across the settings. But if a study is in another area, then it's not transferable across to child foster care, and that's because there are additional federal requirements for child foster care programs. Sections 20 and 21 amend the provisions governing background studies by the department as well as counties. Counties is in section 21. To clarify the current law regarding when an expungement is effective against the commissioner, to clarify that it's not effective unless that order the commissioner to seal the commissioner's records. And then it also specifies that when we have reasonable cause to believe the identity of background study subject is uncertain, we can require a set of fingerprints. I'm sorry, the A1 amendment here also added a section 245C05, a section to be renumbered, that amends our privacy notice to the background study subject related to the NET study piece that I mentioned before. That NET study, our electronic transmission system, must also include a notice to the individual when a study is submitted using that, or if the study is submitted by a form, which is the minority of our cases, that if there was a previous study that received a set-aside, it will be reviewed, and without further contact with the subject, we will then notify the agency initiating the subsequent study of the disqualification. Now going on to Section 23. Section 23.
If I might interrupt for a moment, Mr. Chair.
Senator Newman.
If we could go back to Section 22.
Of course.
I'm looking at the bill on page 26, lines 17 and 18. We are talking about the difference of the commissioner shall versus the commissioner may review arrest and investigatory information. When I look at that kind of language, it makes me wonder why the commissioner would be required to look at, for instance, arrest information. There are times in this world when people are arrested and they haven't done anything wrong, and I'd like to hear from the department on the justification for being able to review records for purposes of licensure for someone just being arrested and very likely or possibly hasn't committed a crime.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is current law that we review arrest and investigative records, and this is just clarifying that it's mandatory to do that, that this is a list of items. The reason, Senator Newman, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is because our law, in addition to disqualifying individuals for a conviction, the law also requires us to disqualify individuals based on a preponderance of evidence of a disqualifying offense. And so in making that determination, we review all criminal records that the individual has. Even if those don't contain a conviction, those may contain charges, complaints, arrest, law enforcement information, arrest records, witness statements. All of those records that are obtained in the background study pursuant to this authority are then reviewed to determine if there's a preponderance of evidence of a disqualifying offense.
So, Ms. Ruster, are you saying that the law currently says that the commissioner may, but it is the practice of the department to always review these things, and so is this just a conforming change to practice? Is that your point?
The law, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the law currently states that if we have reasonable cause, we may review this information, and that's the issue, and that's why I mentioned with Section 17, it's conforming to that, because we had the issue come up, is it required or is it discretionary? And we apply uniform standards across our background studies, so in every case where we have reasonable cause, we're going to obtain that information. We're not going to apply our discretion and do it in some cases and not others, but when it meets the standards, then we're going to apply it across the board, so it in essence is mandatory in those cases.
Right.
That was the intent, to clarify that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I kind of wondered about that same language. I guess it doesn't make a whole lot of difference if they're reviewing it anyway. But again, you said it's preponderance of the evidence if I've got an arrest record for something and no conviction, no anything else, you can still, if the preponderance of the evidence is I did whatever the disqualifying action would be, that you can deny me the license even though I wasn't convicted of anything.
Ms. Rust.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, in the context of a background study, we would review the entire record, including arrests and investigative records. If it rose to that level of a preponderance of evidence, then there would be a disqualification. It would not automatically be a license denial or a licensing sanction. It would be a background study disqualification with the due process that would then follow.
Other questions? Please continue.
Moving on to Section 23. Section 23 clarifies that all individuals are disqualified under the background studies law for direct contact and access. Section 24 amends the provisions that specify the disqualifying offenses in 245C15 subdivisions 1 through 4. And just briefly, the structure of that section is that disqualifications are set up under a permanent disqualification basis, a 15-year, 10-year, and 7-year, corresponding to felonies, gross misdemeanors, and misdemeanors. The revisions, amendments to this section are, first of all of the subdivisions delete obsolete language from the provisions directing how we determine the disqualification look-back period for the preponderance of evidence disqualifications I was just discussing. Subdivision 1 adds the offense of interference with privacy against a minor as a permanent disqualification.
Could you, I know this isn't the Judiciary Committee, but could you just explain what that is?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you want me to explain what interference of privacy of a minor is?
The reference you're referring to, the addition of this as a disqualification 609.746, interference with privacy. What is that offense?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, 609.746, interference with privacy against a minor, is a crime in the what we've seen occur. Drilling a hole in a bathroom in a foster care setting and peeping into that hole. That's one of the things that would be under that crime, but it's those types of things that would fall.
So if I go and read my minor child's diary, that wouldn't be a criminal offense, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that would not meet the elements of that crime. But that's the example I gave you was a real one that came up.
Mr. Chairman, I think the, you know, peeping Toms, videotaping children, using peepholes, I think that's really what that statute is getting at, a bit perverted.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, I swear every year I have been on this committee, the department has come in and added stuff to this list. And, I thought we were supposed to all be about jobs this year, and here we are, more ways to make sure somebody doesn't get a job. Now, these things are crimes. Yes, they are. But we also have a section of law that says once you've done your time, you are considered rehabilitated, and you should be able to go get housing, jobs, all those kinds of things. And I apologize that I haven't done it, but I have for quite some time thought that we ought to actually put a bipartisan task force together and try and look through these things and see, whether there are really crimes in here that don't deserve a permanent strike off or a 15-year strike off or 7 years or whatever. Issuance of a dishonored check, is that really a 15-year disqualification to do some of the most menial work that we do in this state? Possession of shoplifting gear, does that really have something to do with what we do? I mean, you can just look through page after page after page. And some of these, absolutely we want to make sure that we're protecting the people who are being served from the people who committed these crimes, but holy cow. I mean, I see page after page after page after page, and all I think is we have people looking for work. We have businesses are looking for workers, and we have people who have done their time and are considered to be people we should give a chance to again. So there's a disconnect here. And every time we get to this section of law, I think I make this same speech. And I apologize for that. But I'm thinking we can do better. And if we have some good-minded people who can think about ways to do better, we should do it.
And Senator Higgins, I share some of that. And I know in past years there's been a few attempts to try to do that and not very successfully. And I think it would be probably useful to have some bipartisan examination. I think that is a concern that we all ought to have is when people do their time, if that becomes an impediment for them ever getting a job in the normal world, then I guess we're just encouraging them to continue to go back to their old ways. But I appreciate your point, and this is probably not the right time to try
Chairman.
To sort that out. But I did have one question, though, to that. On page 29, under the 15-year disqualifications, on line 29.2, 609.215, suicide. I understand if you commit the crime of suicide, that might be a disqualification, but do we really have to list that in the...
And you're not looking for
Mr.
a job
Chair.
Right after that either.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what line were you on?
This is 29.2.
Mr. Chair, the crime, when you look at the crime, what it really is spelling out is assisting with it in the individual's committing of suicide. It isn't the act against oneself.
As I said, this isn't the Judiciary Committee, so we probably don't know all that. Senator Marty, if you have a question.
Mr. Chairman, nonetheless, a good point. I wonder, in response to Senator Higgins' point, I think I understand, and I think it's appropriate the department comes in and says interference with the privacy, if it's peephole type of thing. I think those are the very folks you don't want to have having licenses. But I also wonder, like Senator Higgins put out some good ones, possession of shoplifting gear. I wonder what shoplifting gear is. It looks like a shopping bag to me, but I don't mean to belittle that offense or anything, but I wonder if the department could, without a task force or anything else, when they come in with some new list next year, take a look at and question whether some of these are in the right categories. These are the 15-year disqualifications. I almost wonder if the department, when you're putting together, here's a reason we got to deal with this interference of privacy. I understand that. Could you also go through maybe by next year and say, look, possession of shoplifting gear, we don't know why that was put in there, or if it was put in there for good reason, maybe tell us what it is. But I just, sometime in the next year, it might be a nice thing if you could do that, because I think her point is well taken.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
Senator Higgins, please don't apologize for bringing this question up. I think it's absolutely appropriate. And, you know, I have been through these lists innumerable times, and there are permanent disqualifications in here without the possibility of a waiver. There's the 15-year, 10-year, 7-year, and what you have pointed out is absolutely correct, that you are literally preventing people from participating in their chosen vocation. And I really do struggle with whether you should be banned from dealing with children if you have got, by a preponderance of the evidence, been accused of shoplifting. So my promise to you is this, Senator Higgins, I am in the process of drafting legislation that I will be coming back with next year that in part is going to address some of these questions. I'll be looking for your signature on the bill.
Very good.
Be happy to help.
Let's please continue. We are members a little bit beyond our allotted time. I don't think we're running up against another committee rushing in here, but I would like to try to conclude this if possible here this afternoon. And Ms. Russ.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, then subdivision 2 adds that same crime, not as a permanent disqualifier, but as a 15-year for any interference with privacy. Again, based on the situations we're seeing, we felt that was necessary to add that. There is one disqualification that the delete A1 amendment actually deleted disorderly conduct, which you'll see there arising out of a charge of domestic. That's gone in the A1 amendment. Section 25, this was also deleted in the A1. Sections 26 and 27 amend the contested case hearing provisions, again conforming amendments to Section 10, which I've discussed today. Section 28, wanting to make sure here to get in the A1 amendments, excuse me. Section 25, as I said, was deleted and new language is added. This language amends the scope of the set-aside provision on previous set-asides. There's a number of things we're doing in this bill to address previous set-asides. It's efficiencies. It's speeding up the process for individuals who we've looked at before. They have a new study. Nothing has changed. That's what these amendments are about. If all the criteria are met, then the previous set-aside will remain in effect in the new Section 25. I've addressed Sections 26 and 27 as conforming to Section 10. Section 28 clarifies by reformatting current language that providing when an individual does not challenge the correctness of a disqualification, the disqualification is conclusive. And this is regarding when the due process related to the disqualifications we've been talking about today. If they don't exercise their due process rights, then that correctness is going to be conclusive. Section 29 clarifies, again, conforming amendments in the Fair Hearing Statute, conforming amendments with Section 10 regarding the scope of the hearing. And lastly, in the A1 amendment, delete Sections 30 through 34, which were the reporting of maltreatment of vulnerable adults law. Those provisions have been pulled. They were looking at changing dispositions. They need further discussion and input.
Thank you, Ms. Rust. Are there questions for the witnesses or for the author of the bill? Seeing none, Senator Newman, my understanding is that this bill needs to be seen in judiciary, although I don't really know why. No. If you would like to make the motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And yes, Senator Limmer has requested this bill. And there are a number of issues in this bill that I did not bring up in this hearing because I felt that they were more appropriate to be addressed in judiciary.
And I just would invite the members of the department to, when it gets to judiciary, if you would like to revisit the issue that we deleted in our oral amendment, certainly feel free.
Well, my motion, Mr. Chairman, would be to send this bill to judiciary.
Senator Newman moves that Senate File 1305 be recommended, passed, and referred to the Judiciary Committee as amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. Thank you, members. Thank you, Senator Newman. Thank you, witnesses. And we are adjourned.
Thank you.